In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
While the nation's attention has been on Houston and now Florida, here in Oregon, we don't need hurricanes to create natural disasters. We have environmentalists for that. It's a funny thing. You'd think environmentalists would care about, the environment. But as you'll hear on today's show, their policies have had the exact opposite effect. Why? It's because despite their claims, environmental policies are not based on actual science. We've said it before, bad information leads to bad policies lead to bad decisions, and that harms everyone. And right now, the bad information that led to bad environmental policies have led to hundreds of thousands of acres of forest fires all across Oregon. On today's show, you'll hear why and how we've come to this. You'll hear some surprising insights into why so many acres are burning. You might be surprised to hear the common denominator in where all of these fires are happening, and it might even surprise you where they're not burning and why that is. This is a huge waste of resources and mismanagement on the part of our leaders in Salem. Houston, and likely most of Florida, is going to need an enormous amount of wood to rebuild. You'll hear some jaw-dropping figures on how many jobs we've missed out on. But I truly hope that by the end of this show, it will make you angry. Because what's going on now, letting hundreds of thousands of acres just burn, is nonsense. Sheer stupidity. And it needs to stop. Salem has got to start listening to people in rural areas. People who know the land, who know how to manage forests, and who know how to do all of that responsibly and make a living at it. If Portland and Eugene want to increase internet speeds, they don't call a wheat farmer on how to do it. If Portland wants to improve its traffic flows, they don't ask a rancher on how to time stoplights. Why is Portland getting to decide whether or not rural people can harvest timber? Why is Portland getting to decide that it's better to let forests rot or burn than to harvest the trees that will create jobs and pay for schools? Remember, the environmentalists all said we wouldn't need to harvest timber anymore because timber jobs would be replaced with money from ecotourists who would be flooding the forests. How many ecotourists from Portland and Eugene are going to go visit the charred remains of those forests now? I'd like to welcome Dr. Bob Zybak. He holds a PhD from Oregon State University in environmental science. His academic focus was in wildfires, and he is a longtime consultant for iSpy Radio. Bob, it's always good to talk to you.
Good talking to you, Mark.
So we've got this situation here in Oregon where these wildfires are basically feeling like they're out of control in many of these, and some of them have been purposefully not managed. I know, especially down in Southwest Oregon, they are extremely mad. In our Cajo listing area, they are extremely mad that they just decided not to fight that fire down there, and it just exploded down there. So let's start with maybe an overall look at what's going on here in Oregon. About how many fires are burning right now across Oregon?
I think about 2 to 3 dozen. The number of fires is variable, and it becomes smaller. Oddly, because several years ago they started inventing complexes, and instead of having 13 fires or 20 fires like they had in the North Umpqua, they counted as one fire. But there's probably about 25 named fires and complexes of significant size burning out of control.
So in terms of acres, though, about how many acres are we talking about that are currently on fire? I know that the Oregonian said as of August 27th, there was over 320,000 acres, that is half the size of the state of Rhode Island, that were ablaze. Is that still pretty much true?
Well, there's two sets of fires, really. The Eastern Oregon fires, we don't really need to count. Those are fairly, they're kind of rejuvenating. The brush fields and grasslands, there's weeds there that the fires impact. But those fires, it's not fair to measure them in acreages. In Western Oregon, from California to Washington, where all the Douglas fir region, where all the major fuels are located in these fires, it's approaching 500,000 acres.
Wow. And out of those 2 to 3 dozen fires that are currently burning, how many of them are out of control?
Well, it depends. I would say it's out of control if you got people standing around watching them burn. So that's a, really? a judgment call. All of them, to some degree or another, are out of control. Some of them are 10% or 30% contained, whatever that means, because that can change with the wind.
Well, speaking of wind, I thought that was one of the more interesting things that happened this last week, where you had the Eagle Creek fire up in the Columbia Gorge. That fire actually jumped the entire Columbia and set a blaze going there in Washington. How common is that to happen?
It's not real common, but there's records of it going back to at least 1902. The 1902 complexes and the 1910 complexes were occurring on both sides of the Columbia, and it's quite likely. I think the Yakult fire was traced to Oregon. That's 1902. So it's not a real common just because these types of wildfires aren't that common. But when you've got fires burning along the Columbia, that's why fire safe zones and that are kind of a makeshift type of approach, because a fire creates its own weather and
yes.
its own winds, and it can cast, as we just saw, embers all the way across the Columbia River. So 2 and 3 miles in advance is fairly common.
Well, and that's why I think this is so puzzling for people here in Oregon that have experienced these in the past. It gets so frustrating when we hear of like what has happened in a number of fires this year, where they have just decided not to fight them, as we know that these things can spread very easily. Let's go ahead and take a break there. Coming back, we'll be talking about why all of this is happening and also the surprising reason about where they're all happening. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking today to Dr. Bob Zybak. He holds a PhD from OSU, that's Oregon State University, in environmental sciences. Academic focus was in wildfires and has been following this for 30 years or more. Dr. Zybak is one of our longtime consultants here for iSpy Radio and a frequent guest, especially when it comes to anything forest-related here in Oregon. So we've got an interesting situation here, not just why this is happening, but also where these fires are happening. And why don't you talk to us a little bit about that?
Well, not surprisingly to those of us that study wildfire, all of these major fires, the 9 or 10 biggest fires, one's over 10,000 acres, are all on federal land.
Hmm.
So, and that's been the pattern since about 1987. Wilderness, like Chelmeopsis Wilderness, is now burned for the third time since 1987. The Millie Fire is on the Three Sisters Wilderness. The Whitewater Fire is on the Mount Jefferson Wilderness. So these wilderness areas that were set aside in the late 60s, and then as buttressed by EPA and ESA regulations on federal lands, have resulted in predictable and predicted fire bombs.
Mm.
In the early 90s, myself and several other people said, we can't have passive management on these lands or they will burn up. And that's just what's been happening.
Well, I know that you have done a number of presentations since the whole spotted owl policies hijacked forest management back in the late 80s and 90s. And back then, you were predicting that this is exactly what we'd see. I mean, I just can't believe that we've seen 30 years of these types of fires, and nobody seems to say, hey, you know, maybe it's time that we start changing our forest management policies.
Well, when I was making predictions on these fires as a reforestation contractor out of Eddyville, most loggers, some of the hunters, lots of the fishermen, people that live in rural areas, farmers, understand exactly what's happening. The surprise has been that the urban populations, the I-5 corridor from Eugene to Portland to Seattle and so on, seem to have fallen for this mythology of fire return intervals and natural fires and so on. And so that type of thinking resulted in regulations that resulted in entirely different management options, say from the 50s and 60s and 70s, when I was a young person, and it's resulted in predictable, out-of-control wildfires.
So if I hear you correctly, in terms of if you could narrow this down to one particular reason why this is happening this year, it can be pretty much all traced back to environmental policies.
Mismanagement. Hmm. Passive management of resources and passive management of wildfire. That's a real common denominator from 1987 until now.
Well, so in terms of environmental policies, you mentioned that a lot of these are on the federal lands. So
all of the major ones, and that's been typical for the last 30 years.
But now we have a new president. So where's the EPA in this? Where's the U.S. Forest Department in all this? I mean, Trump is, you know, usually pretty good about going after these kinds of things. He has certainly put in some better people than we've had under Obama. Why are they not doing anything about this?
They're not doing anything in the West, really. I mean, when you see what Trump is doing as far as regulations, it's the coal industry, it's manufacturing. But Western forests, Western ranching, commercial fishing, Western mining, those issues, he doesn't even have people in place, I don't think. Hmm. But it is hopefully possible that they will get some focus on wildfires and begin taking corrective actions with some of these regulations and policies that have led to these situations.
So in terms of the management of this, this is an interior management, I mean, the Department of Interior, or is it it's a subset of a different department?
It's agriculture and interior. BLM lands are interior. Forest Service lands are our Department of Agriculture, and so it's those two agencies in particular. But ESA, Endangered Species Act, EPA, Clean Water, Clean Air, NOAA, fish have all regulated our forest into a situation that was predicted and is now happening, and has been happening for decades.
Is that part of the problem, then, that we have so many agencies issuing these types of regulations, that you've got this confluence of regulations that are preventing good management?
They're forcing bad management. It's that simple. Wow. Riparian zone science, and there's quotes around science there, has resulted in so-called buffers along streams.
Yes.
That on steep hillsides, and the Biscuit Fire should have taught them something on this in 2002, become chimneys. In 2005, we had the Deer Creek Fire. Because of riparian shrubs, the fire went from probably a cigarette or maybe a firecracker or something tossed out of a car into 4,000 acres and several homes being burnt. So a lot of these policies, in particularly let it burn, policies, but also passive management, you know, remove the roads, leave buffers, leave fuels all over the ground, coarse woody debris, which, because it's federal government, they call CWD or LWD, large woody debris. Those are just fuel for a fire that will burn at some point, whether a person sets it or lightning sets it.
In terms of the state lands, are we actively fighting the fires that are on the state lands? I mean, why aren't we seeing them on state lands?
Well, the main reason on the state lands is because they were already burnt clean. The Tillamook State Forest from 1933 to 51 was burnt clean, and myself and other school children in the 50s planted trees on it in the 60s, and then it became a state forest, and now it's wildlife habitat that needs buffers or something. It's pretty nutty. And the same thing, the Elliott State Forest was the 1868 Coos Fire, and then repeated burns through the 1880s, a lot set on purpose by people running stock and that type of thing. That's the main reason that the state is not facing fires, is because they have inherited burnt-out lands.
Well, I was going to say, maybe we're seeing some better management there, but apparently we are not. All right, everyone, stay with us. We're going to have more with Dr. Bob Zybak. Coming back, we'll be continuing our discussion about why all of this is happening. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show, keeping an eye on big government And we're talking with Dr. Bob Zybak this week about the Oregon State fires here. He has a PhD in environmental sciences, and his academic focus was on wildfires. Been following this for more than 30 years. And it's just astonishing to see this level of forest fires. You know, we always get forest fires every year, just can't avoid those. But this year, it just seems to be the exact opposite of what we ought to be doing. In fact, we were talking during the break there that in the last segment, it was astonishing to hear that, you know, all of the fires are happening on the federal lands, and state lands seem to be doing pretty well. And I was thinking, well, maybe that's an example of, you know, managing things locally here on the state level. But it turns out that the reason they're not burning is because they have already burned, and there was none of that undergrowth there to ignite the fires. But so in terms of Oregon, I guess we're kind of the example of what not to do in terms of if you were to turn over federal lands back to the states.
Well, the recent suit by Linn County for mismanagement of state lands, the recent efforts of our state land boards to sell the Elliott at 25 cents on the dollar, get rid of it, current decisions to borrow money to buy a bond to pay off trustee obligations. I mean, it's for the last 20-25 years, the Department of the Oregon Board of Forestry and the State Land Board have been peopled by politicians and people with an agenda, rather than foresters, rather than loggers, rather than people that know the land and know how to manage trees. We've got a lot of people that are dealing, some of them with agendas, and theoretically, but mostly a total lack of experience. And the result is what we're seeing: Linn County suit, Elliott State Forest, and so on. Lack of losing money on our school lands, school trust lands.
Yes.
We're the first. There's 20 states that have school trust lands. Oregon is the only one that's ever lost money, and we've got some of the most valuable school trust lands ever. So how did we do that? And then you start looking at that we're building firebombs for the future.
It just gets embarrassing sometimes, especially in terms of thinking how much potential we have. As you mentioned, we've got tremendous state lands that we could be harvesting, that we could be generating funds for schools.
We were required by law to harvest. And
yeah.
Same with the ONC lands. It's not we could be. The law says we have to, and yet they're just ignoring the law, basically. And they're with regulations and pseudoscience pronouncements and that type of thing. And it's been very troubling for the last three decades to watch this taking place.
I know it's always dangerous to put yourself in the mind of a politician. But do they honestly think that letting the forest burn is a better use of that land than harvesting it and selling it?
I don't think they've got enough experience to think about it in those terms. I think what they do is trust the federal government to, and that's what we made the decision on the state 30 years ago. We said, oh, we're going to follow spotted owl regulations. There was no requirement to do it. It was probably against the law to do it, and yet we did it, and resulting a diminishment of income to our schools just on the Elliott alone has been estimated at over $220 million has been lost through lack of active management.
Wow.
As well as creating a situation that's going to be open to windstorms, landslides, and future wildfires.
Well, before I get to the next big question, we've had inquiries about whether or not it's possible that Al-Qaeda and ISIS have potentially set some of these fires. Is there a chance that any of these fires were purposefully set by Al-Qaeda or ISIS affiliates?
It doesn't seem to be. There might be, you know, some kind of isolated case here and there, but they have the same problem the Japanese did during World War II when they tried to start forest fires. They didn't understand our forests or our weather patterns, so they sent over a bunch of incendiary devices, and they did it in the winter on a west wind, and everything rains and is wet here, so they didn't work. And so I would say the same thing. It's not that easy to start a wildfire, and most of these have been lightning ignited for the last 30 years. Before that, it was mostly human, and a lot of that was arson, and some of it still is arson, but it's more likely that the arson is local people for the same reason that poaching is more likely to be local than some kind of outside government intervention.
Well, okay, so if forest fires are not that easy to start...
Oh, one thing, Mark, can I interrupt you just briefly? In your remarks, you said that we always get forest fires, and that's not true. From 1951 until 1987, we had one forest fire in western Oregon.
Wow.
And that's when the land was being actively managed, new roads were being put in, homes were being built as post-World War II housing. Federal lands were being opened to create jobs. They had different organizations in Southwest Oregon, Southwest Washington, in which industry partnered with the government. And we had one fire in 1966. So in 1987, all hell broke loose, and it's still going strong, and people don't seem to be able to learn from these events.
No, unfortunately not.
And, and when I say people, I mean politicians.
Yeah, well, we'll put people in scare quotes there, I guess. But, I should have added that it's been my experience ever since I've been here in Oregon, and I moved out here, and I've been here 20 years now.
Yeah, since 87.
Yeah, so we've had fires every year that I've been here. So,
yep.
Let's go ahead and take a break. I guess we're coming up on one, and what I've got to say here is going to take a little bit of time. So everyone stay with us. We'll have lots more Dr. Bob Zybak talking about the forest fires here in Oregon. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the I Spy Radio Show, talking today about the fires burning all across the state of Oregon. Doing that with Dr. Bob Zybak, who is a longtime consultant here for iSpy. He's got a PhD from OSU in environmental science, and his academic focus was in wildfires. And just to follow up a little bit from that last segment, in terms of why this is all happening, we know for a fact that the state will choose not to fight certain fires, or the feds will opt not to. Is there a valid reason why you would choose not to fight a fire?
Well, there could be valid reasons, but some of them would be like treasonous. You're trying to ruin the economies of the rural areas and let the fires burn up other resources and kill off the wildlife. So that would be a reason, I guess. But I think it's mostly a matter of people that are doing models and offices and bureaucrats that are working for agencies that really don't have a basic understanding of forest history, fire history, and particularly active forest management.
Well, there's this sort of environmental thinking here that sometimes you just need to let nature take its course. And sure enough, a Willamette Week article came out Wednesday and Thursday that basically said that, well, it's a good thing that we had all of this forest fire because now it's going to restore wildlife and vegetation. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, it might be a good thing if we had a cholera epidemic and reduced the the population. I mean, that's absolutely nuts. What's been happening for about the last 30 years is this word natural and natural fire has been promoted as a somehow positive thing for some vague theoretical reasons. But the problem with these people, for the most part, is they don't include humans in their equation of natural. Hmm. So we've got 10,000 years of years of Indian fires, and they just discount that. That didn't happen. It was natural, and the Indians were kind of dependent on the lightning god to rejuvenate the Huckleberry Patch or to keep the Willamette Valley and Rogue River Valley and the Umpqua Valley into oak savanna conditions and wetland prairie conditions. That was all created and maintained by regular fire by people that understood biology.
Wow.
So it's just in the 1820s and 30s when in late 1700s when most of the Indians in western Oregon were decimated mostly by disease, the amount of fire, the need for fire was reduced significantly, and then these lands began being encroached by conifer trees, and those form closed canopies, and after about 100 or so years, they catch on fire, and we're seeing those results. They first started in, we had a series of them from 1849 till about 1883, and then from 1902 to 1933 or 39, But after World War II, we just stopped all the fires by actively managing the land. And then in the late 60s, we started creating wilderness areas where we're not even allowed to use a motor to fight a fire. So that theoretical approach to preserving, which means stopping logging to most of these people or stopping road building, landscapes, flammable landscapes led to predictable wildfires. And that's why myself and other people were predicting them 30 years ago. We were just like, well, you can't let all this fuel build up.
Yeah, well, if you pour gasoline on, if you pour gasoline on the floor, you're probably going to get a fire at some point.
Yeah, there's nothing at all natural about these. They're not good things. They're killing millions of wildlife. They're polluting the air. And people that are right that this is like good stuff are people with their heads up an orifice.
Well, or they live in the middle of, or they, like we see so often, they live in the middle of Portland and don't actually get out into those woods, don't understand those woods, and yet they think they ought to be able to regulate those woods.
And they are able to regulate them. They're
That's right.
Incredibly influential people. They're like pretty much invented the environmental lawyer industry.
Sure.
And now those legal suits have resulted in this type of air pollution, water pollution, mass killing of wildlife, mass destruction of resources that we've been witnessing the last several decades.
It is absolutely as illogical to allow people from Portland that never go out to these rural areas to determine environmental regulations as it would be as having rural people to be able to decide traffic flows in downtown Portland.
Exactly.
We've got to get away from this. And I was really hoping that the fire up there near the Multnomah Falls Lodge would finally drill it in their heads that, you know, you've got to have active forest management. But apparently with the Willamette Week, they're saying this is a good thing and it validates everything that we've been saying, which is, as you say, total nonsense.
Yep.
Let's go ahead and take a break. Coming back, I'd like to talk about the economics of all of this. Oregon has made a huge mistake here and there's a huge missed opportunity. Stay with us. And welcome back to the I Spy Radio Show, talking today to Dr. Bob Zybak about the wildfires here in Oregon, especially focusing on why this is all happening. And in this segment, I'd like to talk a little bit about the huge missed opportunity that Oregon has had in light of recent events. Both Houston has already been hit by a massive hurricane. Now Florida is looking like it's going to be hit. So they've already allocated $6 billion to help rebuild Houston. No guesses yet on what it might be for Florida. A lot of that rebuilding is going to require wood. And so Oregon, once again, loses out on this because of our lack of foresight and our lack of management. I mean, talk to us a little bit about the missed opportunity, economic opportunity Oregon just had here.
Well, following World War II, we had a housing boom that would be similar to what's going to be needed in Texas and Florida and just our growing population in general. And so the national forests were actively managed, sometimes in partnership with industry. And the result was hardly any forest fires, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of jobs, tens of thousands of jobs, and boom times for our schools, our parks, and our rural communities. And then when these artificial shutdowns, starting with wilderness and then EPA regulations and ESA regulations, started accumulating from the late 60s to now, then things fell apart. The rural communities now are, a lot of them, in bad economic shape.
Yeah.
And they're burning up, and there's going our resources. So the opportunity is, if we salvaged these dead trees, finally, for once, they're still sound for another year or two. We could when we had the Columbus Day storm in 1962, it was on a Friday. By Monday morning, the Forest Service, the BLM, and industry had met and formulated a plan for salvage. 72 hours. Now we have things in court for 3, 4, 5, 6 years, and by that time the wood's become checked and rotted, and it's not valuable as building material. So if we say this is an emergency, and those people need products, which they certainly do, we are poised to meet that demand if we can bypass, I can't think of a polite word, regulations that have been imposed on Oregon and the Pacific Northwest and Northern California.
Wow. So how many jobs are we talking about? Let's say that out of just the $6 billion we already know, and let's say that on the wild side, round numbers anyway, $1 billion worth of timber, how many jobs are we talking about to fill an order that large?
It would be thousands and thousands of direct and indirect jobs just for the Elliott Forest, which is only 80,000 acres. If they manage that very conservatively, as they said they were going to do in the 1930s and actually did until the 1980s, that's 5 million board feet or 50 million board feet a year. The multiplier is 440 jobs. That's just a small part of the of Oregon. It's estimated for the entire western United States, if we actively managed our federal lands, it would result in 200 or 300 or 400,000 jobs, mostly rural, mostly family support jobs.
Yeah, those are great jobs. I've heard you speak before that the average salary in timber industry is around $50,000. I mean, that's a great wage. It's far better than the $15 an hour that they're continually shoving up in Portland and Seattle. Let's talk about, though, some of the environmental aspects of this, too. I mean, we have such a double whammy here where we could have been harvesting that timber, and instead that has literally gone up in smoke. So a double loss there. But the left is continuously shrieking about CO2, global warming, and everything else. This is also another double whammy. First, those fires have released a ton of CO2. Into the atmosphere, the very thing they say they're against. And then secondly, it burned up trees that would normally remove CO2 from the atmosphere. So let's start with that first one. How much CO2 would you guess has been put into the atmosphere as a result of these fires?
Well, it'd equal, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of cars. But the point is, after the fire, those trees that are left behind not only are not sequestering carbon dioxide, they're rotting. And so all the dead trees are producing carbon dioxide, too, and that's probably a greater amount than just released in short order from a fire. Now, you can turn it into wood products, and eventually the CO2 is going to get released one way or the other. But the CO2 is a good thing. They've done surveys of forested areas of the Earth, and it's increased 10% in the last 20 or 30 years. Speculation is that increased CO2 in the atmosphere, just like in a greenhouse. I mean, CO2 is a greenhouse gas, not because it traps heat, but because it's food for plants. And so they pump CO2 into greenhouses. That's a good thing. The bad thing is all the particulates, all the things that's bothering your eyes, and asthmatic kids being affected by it, and coughing and sneezing and discomfort and a lack of aesthetics when we're looking at the landscape. That's the bad stuff. All of these particulates that are going into our communities without control. The CO2 is the good part, and the fact that it's been painted as a bogeyman by modelers is just what's happened in forestry. So in climate forestry, we got a bunch of computer jockeys predicting the future with their binary systems, and they're consistently wrong and have been wrong for decades, and yet they're still in control of the situation somehow.
Well, I guess they forget their third grade science, because I remember back then that's what you learned, is that CO2 is a good thing. Yep. Plants need that in order to create oxygen that the rest of us need.
It's the building block of life.
Yeah. Well, but overall, it's such a small a portion of our overall atmosphere, and the man-made part is even smaller. And I did an analysis one time that if you took 100, 200-pound men, put them in a room, and by weight, if you said that's the you equated that on a ratio aspect, if that's all of the gases combined in the atmosphere, the man-made portion of CO2 in that room would be a quarter pounder.
Yep.
And that's what we're so concerned about.
I don't think we're concerned about it. We've been able to misrepresent these problems to the advantage of people that have an agenda. And whether that agenda is anti-logging or anti-rural community or anti-resource management, who knows, who cares? So they make up information and they run it through channels, and they run it through a bunch of lawyers, and now we've got everything in court. Yeah. Rather than foresters and loggers in the woods, we got modelers and bureaucrats keeping them out, and it's difficult to say how they've gotten away with it, but they certainly have.
Well, real quick, we got about 30 seconds here. And having lost all those trees now, how much CO2 would we have been taking out had those trees not been burned up?
Again, over time, it comes out to nothing, because ultimately those trees are going to rot or die. And so if they're ingesting CO2 now, when they die, whether through fire, old age, disease, bugs, whatever, landslide, windstorm, that CO2 is going to be released. Instant uncontrollable release is the problem.
So it's a wash then, it sounds like. And once again,
yes.
It's another myth by the left. So everyone stay with us. We're going to be wrapping up with Dr. Zybak after this. Coming back, we'll be talking about what needs to be done. And welcome back. We're in our final segment now with Dr. Bob Zybak. His academic focus was on wildfires, but he didn't just do things academically. He has 20 years of practical reforestation experience, having gone out there. And would you say you replanted 85,000 acres?
My crews did over a 20-year period. I was in reforestation for about 25 or 30 years, but
wow.
My crews did about 85,000 acres in the Pacific Northwest. Between about 1971 and 1982, so about 8,000 or 9,000 acres a year on average.
Wow!
And none have been subjected to wildfire.
Oh, well, that's pretty awesome. So why is that? That none of them have been subjected to forest fires?
Partly because they're actively managed, and we got roads, and we got access, and we've got ability to put fires out right away, and mostly because it's on private land, and they don't want their investment to burn up. But also for a reason we mentioned earlier, a lot of my work has been done on the Tillamook burn, the Sundance burn, the Aquinna fires, land, the Elliott forest with 1868 Coos fire. So these areas have burnt recently, and they're being, or relatively recently, during historical time, and they're being regenerated to be producing forest crops, and so efforts are made to not let them go to waste.
Yeah, that'd be kind of a sad thing. Your livelihood kind of depends on it.
You know, right word. This has been pretty sad to witness the destruction of our forests and loss of prairies and meadows the last 30 years.
Yeah, well, it's not just sad. I know it's making a lot of people angry, but, you know, I'm just sitting here listening to you, and I'm thinking about these environmentalists and their stupidity.
Yeah.
How many of them would be sitting there at home in their living room, and they've got a nice wood-burning fireplace there, and an ember pops up and lands there on their carpet and starts to smolder, and they just say, oh, let's let nature take its course.
That would be natural.
I just don't see that happening. You know, I would think that they would actually want to get up and dump some water on it, or, you know, their coffee they got from Starbucks or whatever. Yeah, it's just nonsense.
I've spent most of my 70 years in the woods, and this is a true story. I've never seen a spotted owl or an environmentalist out there.
Wow. No, it's because you're in the wrong place.
I see pictures of them climbing trees, or I see pictures of them hooting, but I don't see them in the woods.
Well, you got to go to Starbucks for that sort of thing. That's where you'll run into the environmentalists, or those downtown law offices.
I'll take your word for it.
Yeah, really? Yeah, well.
I think you got to go to a court and meet their lawyers to see how they're spending their money.
Yeah, there you go. Well, you know, like I said, these fires have rightfully made a lot of people very angry. And I'm sure that there is a lot of people out there that would maybe like to do something. But one of the things that, you know, and maybe that means volunteering to go out and reforest or whatnot, but we don't really usually see a lot of volunteer opportunities for this sort of thing. So where are the environmentalists on that? Because I know that I've certainly seen some of these environmental organizations that say they have these volunteers, and they have some nice pictures of people cleaning up things along the river. But in terms of actually doing things, it seems like the most things they do is just sue the government.
Yep, that's what they do. Some of that stuff they've done, I've seen, heard accounts of, it's just piddling around. When you have people that don't know what they're doing, that are handling volunteers, it's a no-win situation. I don't know of any volunteer I know jail crews are forced out to work, and they have a high turnover. It's really hard, difficult work if you know what you're doing. But if you're just out there leaf raking and lawn mowing and piddling around and picking up litter, it's more like what you should do for people that are broken the law. Mm. It's not a fun thing, or you should be well paid to do it, one of the two, but it needs to be done.
Well, in terms of what does need to be done, do you think these fires, especially that one, the Eagle Creek one that was so close to Portland there, mm-hmm. do you think we'll see any policy changes as a result of this forest fire season? And will they be changes for the better?
I hope we have changes in policy due to politics. I doubt it because there's a fire close to Portland any more than the fire close to L.A. or the fire close to San Diego. I thought those would be turning points, that would wake people up. But nope, it doesn't. They rebuild or whatever they do and go about their business, and we keep dealing with the same destructive myths of, you know, natural fires and fire return intervals and that type of thing. I think the best thing people could do is to learn more about what's going on, to become better educated, and then put the feet of the politicians to the fire. Mm. It's like we can't log because of a spotted owl. Well, that doesn't make any sense, and it doesn't really have a strong scientific basis. Same with the marble murrelet. Area burns up, it's all dead trees, we can't salvage them because of a black-backed woodpecker. It's all nonsense, and it's what's happened, the Chetco Bar Fire. In 2002, it was called the Biscuit Fire. In 1987, it was called the Silver Complex. All three of them started in the Calmeopsis Wilderness. That thing has been fried three times now, and because of the dead trees were not salvaged, they get to the ground, and then you have ground fires, and you burn up all the humus in the soil and CO2 that's trapped in the soil, and you really sterilize a lot of the landscape, as well as creating air pollution, water pollution, and killing millions of wildlife. It's not a good situation, and if people think that's natural, they need to stop being vocal in public about it because it's not natural. I'll just leave it at that.
It's natural to have people
smoking, cooking lunch, keeping warm at night, building fires, gathering firewood. That's perfectly natural. It's been going on for millennia, and the environmental movement doesn't seem to understand that.
No, they don't, because mankind shouldn't be here. We're a mistake by nature, apparently. In terms of moving forward in policies, what about salvage operations? Because you mentioned that if we don't salvage this, it's just going to rot, and then it will be a total waste again.
It'll reburn.
Well, not only that, but are they thinking that, let nature take its course, and we'll let it rot, and somehow that'll rejuvenate the forest?
I don't think that's a result of thinking. I think that's a result of groupthink or indoctrination.
Wow.
I think if people, when you think, you have to have facts. And it's good to have experience as well.
Yes, but now
and
you don't.
When you come up with results like that, it shows you don't have experience or insight.
Well, nowadays you don't need to think and you don't need to have facts. You just need to have an opinion. Well, in terms of the future here, I know that a lot of people are very concerned about how long it's going to take for this forest to grow back. What insights can you give us on that?
Well, the Tillamook fires took about 20 years. In 1948, we voted to reforest them, and by the 60s, it was fairly well reforested, and we had good standing merchantable timber and wildlife habitat by the 80s. Without doing that, they'll never recover. If they just keep abandoning the land and letting it go to brush and wildfires, that's what will happen. Yeah. It's predictable, and they just but their models don't show that somehow.
Yeah. Well, Bob, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Well, I appreciate the discussion. It's been fun.
All right. If today's show made you angry, I hope you'll do something about it. Here's one thing you can do. On Monday, we'll have this week's show available for free download. Send your representative the link to today's show and ask them, as their constituent, to listen to it and tell them that you are demanding a change in our forest policies. Don't know who your rep is? We'll have that for you, too. But it's not just the state level. We have to contact the federal level as well. And we'll have links to do all of that on this week's show page. Just head to iSpyRadio.com. That's iSpyRadio.com. And at the top of the page, you can follow the links to this week's show or to the Take Action page. We'll have information on both. This has to stop. It's time that rural people get to decide what happens in rural areas. Do visit those links. Do hold your representatives accountable. They work for you, and it's time that you remind them of that. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.